Hello, we are starting with an October issue, and we're starting with an ode in October to an orca. A photographer takes the plunge into forbidding waters off Norway for an extraordinary encounter with orcas by Pete McBride. The water is cold inside Norway's northernmost fjords. When I slipped in headfirst, wearing a thick wetsuit, the 40-degree Fahrenheit surface temperature made the water feel dense and biting on my exposed face. Diving down, I felt myself crossing a threshold into another world, dark, frigid, seemingly bottomless, and home to giant carnivores that eat fish, seals, and porpoises. If you want to see wild orcas, they can be found in every ocean, from the Arctic to Antarctic. Despite their killer whale nickname, orcas don't prey on humans. But they're the largest dolphins on the planet. With 7 main ecotypes that vary in pigmentation pattern, diet, and sonar dialect. Members of these groups don't usually mate with one another, though scientists are divided on whether to consider them different species. The coast of British Columbia is a popular orca watching spot. So are Argentina's Valdez Peninsula and Australia's Bremer Bay. But in most countries, there's a limit to how close you're allowed to get. That's not the case in Norway, which has no laws against swimming with dolphins and whales. The country's whaling laws are notoriously lax. This makes Norway an alluring destination for orca lovers, but it can also lead to danger for both humans and animals. At one point, during my visit, I saw 3 young tourists from Spain block a pod of orcas with their sailboat, jump into the water, and try to approach by paddleboard. Their tactics scared the orcas into hiding far below the surface. What's more, the Spanish tourists could have ended up stranded out there beyond the fjords, 3 miles from the nearest shoreline, left to the mercy of the fierce Arctic weather and currents. My tour operator, Jacques DeVos, went to great lengths to avoid such situations. DeVos is a South African-born diver who has been studying orcas in this region for the last 7 winters and has a reputation for being sensitive to the animals and their habitat. DeVos knows how to locate orcas without disturbing the pods or breaking up families. The orcas in this area feed on herring, which they corral into clusters called bait balls. It takes a lot of energy for cold water mammals to orchestrate these feeding sessions, and DeVos makes sure his divers don't get in the way. He uses his radio to stay in touch with nearby researchers so he can stay attuned to the animals' behaviors and help locate individual members of the pods. I went to Norway partly because of COVID-19 pandemic presented unusual reasons to photograph orcas in their element. There were far fewer commercial tours operating, so the animals would be less harassed. More important, as shipping and fishing slowed worldwide, researchers were able to identify more whale and dolphin vocalizations, not only more sounds, but ones they never heard before. We've been hearing vocalizations that were new to us and different from what we have gotten in the last 6 years, says DeVos. For lack of a better word, it sounds more energetic. I was eager to feel that energy firsthand. Before DeVos would let me swim with the orcas, I spent a day on board learning about their behavior. He tested my swimming ability, watching me carefully as I dove and climbed back into the boat, weighed down with diving gear. I listened to his instructions. Don't swim aggressively toward the orcas. Move calmly and let them come to you. Don't splash your flippers loudly on the surface or make jerky motions. Before we slid into the sea, DeVos played me a recording full of clicks, whistles, and zipper-like sounds. Amazingly, each orca pod uses its own distinct language of notes and tones. Behind the orca conversations, I heard the moans of humpback whales. DeVos pays attention to humpbacks, too. They tend to follow orcas and steal their bait balls. Humpbacks can be as large as 50 feet long and weigh over 40 tons. They don't attack humans, but once in a while they inadvertently scoop up divers who get too close to their food. This reportedly happened to a New England lobster diver in June. The whale spat him out, and he survived. On the recording DeVos played for me, the humpbacks called to each other in low baritones, ascending the music scale. DeVos explained that low and high notes travel differently. A whale will call out to a podmate, and the pitch of the reply may indicate how far away it is. DeVos compares the giant creatures to truck drivers speaking to each other on different radio channels. I never knew how powerful an orca's sonar pulse could be until I got into the water and felt one reverberate deep in my chest, like the bass at a rock concert. The sensation was so weirdly moving. I hooted through my snorkel, because when a six-tongue orca swims directly at you and pings you with his echolocation device, trying to identify who and what is swimming in his Arctic hunting waters, you realize you are in a completely alien world. I swam alongside this 25-foot-long male for a few moments. We looked each other in the eye before he surfaced for a breath. His 6-foot dorsal fin broke the water just yards in front of me, and I glimpsed the snow-capped peaks on each side of the fjord before he accelerated back down into the darkness with one swoosh of his fluke. Through my wetsuit hoodie, I faintly heard a click and a high-pitched whistle. Two female orcas appeared about 20 feet below me, corralling herring into a bait ball. The pair seemed unbothered as I dove down to get a closer look. They started pushing the herring toward me as if I had arrived to help. Suddenly, the male re-emerged from the depths. As he glided next to me, his pectoral fin, nearly the size of my entire body, slid under my stomach. We eyed each other again before he rolled left and swept his dorsal fin, the size of a small plane's tail, just over my head. The strafe felt more playful than territorial. Like an orca high five. A moment of connection with an enormous intelligent being and a place where sound is sight and the noisy natural glory of nature still reigns. When I got back to the surface, I noticed fins all around. Then I caught a flash of white. The humpback baritones had arrived, coming in to steal the orca's lunch. In an instant, herring flashed and scattered as a humpback, mouth ajar, scooped up the majority of the bait ball in a single gulp. It looked like a submarine passing just below my flippers. The early night was exploding in the green and burgundy waves of the northern lights when I met with Eve Jourdain and Richard Carolusen, founders of the Norway Orca Survey. In the last 7 years, they've used dorsal fin shapes and patterns to identify more than 1,200 of the estimated 3,000 orcas that winter in Norway. This work is crucial. Right now, the International Union for Conservation of Nature classifies orcas as data deficient. Some of their populations might be endangered, but there just isn't enough information to be sure. Kara Lucen and Jourdain are the only researchers in Norway doing this kind of meticulous tracking. Jourdain is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Oslo. Kara Lucen, a Norwegian boat and drone pilot, grew up eating whale meat. "I used to see whales as just another fish," he says. "Today I see incredibly intelligent animals." He and Jourdain take blubber biopsies to check the orca's diets and measure hormonal levels for stress indications. They suspect their data will show a decrease in stress levels during the pandemic. I showed Jourdain the underwater photo I'd taken of the male who'd given me a high five. That's Melvin. He is 25 to 30 years old. "He comes every year," she said, "and he only eats fish, not seals like some of the other orcas. Melvin was caught in a fishing net in 2016, she told me. The next day I joined Jourdain and Kara Lucen on their small research boat. In the amber light, they communicated by radio with DeVos and another freediving outfitter called Valhalla. By 11:30 a.m., we were following a pod of 8 orcas, carefully matching their speed while keeping our distance. The pod kept surfacing near us as we moved steadily southeast. Jourdain photographed individual dorsal fins for the database. A few minutes later, the orca's misty spray was right next to us, just before their bodies slid beneath the water and out of our sight. The author and photographer, Pete McBride, has traveled to over 75 countries in the last 20 years. He is working on a book about silence. Our next article is also science, but more of the human nature. The article is titled, "How Science Conquered Diphtheria, the Plague Among Children." It was highly contagious, lethal, and mysterious. Then medical experts developed treatments and vaccines, and the affliction disappeared, but not entirely, by Perry Klass. Even Noah Webster, that master of words, did not have a name for the terrible sickness. In May 1735, he wrote in a brief history of epidemic and pestilential diseases, "In a wet, cold season, appeared at Kingston, an inland town in New Hampshire, situated in a low plain, a disease among children, commonly called the throat distemper, of a most malignant kind, and by far the most fatal ever known in this country." Webster noted the symptoms, including general weakness and a swollen neck. "The disease moved through the colonies," he wrote, "and gradually traveled southward, almost stripping the country of children. It was literally the plague among children. Many families lost 3 and 4 children. Many lost all. And children who survived generally went on to die young," he wrote from his vantage point of more than half a century later. "The throat distemper had somehow weakened their bodies." In 1821, a French physician, Pierre Brontenu, gave the disease a name, diphtheritis. He based it on the Greek word diphthera for leather, a reference to the affliction's signature physical feature, a thick, leathery buildup of dead tissue in a patient's throat, which makes breathing and swallowing difficult or impossible. and children with their relatively small airways were particularly vulnerable. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, diphtheria challenged doctors with the terrible specter of children choked, smothered, snuffed out. It brought terror to the richest and the poorest, blighting famous families and anonymous ones. Queen Victoria's daughter, Princess Alice, died of diphtheria in 1878 at the age of 35. Five of Alice's children had also been sick with the disease, along with her husband, the Grand Duke of Hesse-Darmstadt. Their youngest child died. The tragedy prompted the Sanitary Journal to warn readers of the kiss of death that had most likely spread the disease through the royal family. The greatest care and thoughtfulness should be exercised in these cases of simple sore throat, as in the severe cases, and it should be constantly borne in mind that kissing of children at such times is most dangerous. While there was some understanding of how the illness spread by what we would now call respiratory droplet, through coughing or sneezing or kissing, the actual underlying cause was not yet known. In the meantime, it was a leading cause of death for children around the world. Diphtheria contributed to that notion that childhood was not a safe time, that many children would die by the age of 10, says Evelyn M. Hammonds, a professor of the history of science and African American studies at Harvard, and the author of Childhood's Deadly Scourge, a chronicle of early efforts to control the disease in New York City. Then, toward the end of the 19th century, scientists started identifying the bacteria that caused this human misery, giving the pathogen a name and delineating its poisonous weapon. It was diphtheria that led researchers around the world to unite in an unprecedented effort, using laboratory investigations to come up with new treatments for struggling, suffocating victims. And it was diphtheria that prompted doctors and public health officials to coordinate their efforts in cities worldwide, taking much of the terror out of the deadly disease. In my more than 30 years as a practicing pediatrician, I have never seen a single patient with diphtheria. That's because vaccination efforts in this country have been so successful. In the 1980s, when I was training, there were only a few cases a year in the United States. Since 2000, there have been only 6 reported cases in the U.S. And yet, the diphtheria story isn't over. A recent analysis led by a researcher at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention noted some 8,800 cases reported overseas in 2017. In places where people aren't getting vaccinated or are slacking off on booster shots, diphtheria is finding its way back. And the standard treatment, little changed in more than a century, is in short supply. I was inspired to become a doctor partly by Paul de Kruijff's 1926 book, Microbe Hunters, a thrilling, even swashbuckling adventure about the encounters between humans and microbes. Among other things, it describes the French scientist Emile Roux, who had been Louis Pasteur's assistant, and the German scientist Emil von Behring, trying to find a way to keep diphtheria from killing children in the 1880s in Paris. The wards of the hospitals for sick children were melancholy, with a forlorn wailing. There were gurgling coughs foretelling suffocation. On the sad rows of narrow beds were white pillows framing small faces blue with the strangling grip of an unknown hand. One of the doctors who walked these wards in New York City around the same time was Abraham Jacoby, often called the father of American pediatrics. A Prussian-born Jew, educated at the University of Bonn, Jacoby founded the first free clinic for children in New York City, and in 1860 was appointed the first professor of pediatrics at New York Medical College. He was interested in research-based pediatrics and patient-oriented medicine, as well as in what we would now call the social determinants of health, the ways poverty and family circumstances and other realities of children's living conditions shape their well-being. It's partly because of Jacoby that this awareness has been included in U.S. pediatric training and practice for more than 100 years. In January 1860, at a meeting of the New York Academy of Medicine, Jacoby reported seeing 122 children with diphtheria at the Canal Street Dispensary, though other doctors had reported seeing none. Some doctors might have been misdiagnosing diphtheria as a form of croup, a disease we now know as a relatively common and far less deadly infection of the airway. 20 years later, Jacoby put his vast clinical experience into a treatise on diphtheria, in which he described how he himself became affected with diphtheric pharyngitis, followed by a tedious catarrh consequent upon sucking the wound during the performance of tracheotomy in an 8-year-old child. Almost all of his more than 200 attempts at tracheotomy, cutting the neck to open the windpipe, ended in failure. The only reason he made this last-ditch surgical effort was the utter impossibility of witnessing a child's dying from asphyxia. Jacoby was married to another doctor, the brilliant Mary Putnam, who had trained at the Female Medical College of Pennsylvania, and then at the École des Médecine at the Sorbonne, where she was the first ever female medical student. The couple had a son and a daughter, Ernst and Marjorie. In 1883, both came down with diphtheria. Jacoby would later tell a story about a family resembling his own, blaming the infection on the trustworthy nurse. Scholars have speculated that Jacoby may have been unable to face the possibility that he himself may have brought the infection home from the clinic. Marjorie recovered, but Ernst died at the age of 7. There was nothing doctors could do, even for their own children. Jacoby was skeptical of the idea that diphtheria was caused by any particular bacteria. But in 1883, the same year Ernst died from the disease, the Prussian pathologist Edwin Klebs found a bacterium lurking in the leathery tissue known as a pseudomembrane that can block a patient's airway. Friedrich Leifler, a German bacteriologist, took this microbe and grew it in the lab to solve the mystery of whether it was indeed the cause of the disease. He followed a set of rules laid down by Robert Koch, one of the founding fathers of bacteriology. To establish that a microorganism causes a disease, Koch's postulates state that you must show it is present in every case, it can be grown in a laboratory, the lab-cultured organism can cause the disease in a new host, the microorganism can again be isolated from the new host. My medical school had us memorize Cox postulates, even though we knew then, by then, that they didn't apply to every type of infection. Leifler infected guinea pigs, rabbits, horses, and dogs with his lab-grown cultures. The bacterium came to be known as the Klebs Leifler bacillus. Then, in 1888, Rue and Alexandre Yersin, medical doctors at the Institut Pasteur in Paris, took another big step when they showed that a substance secreted by the bacteria was the particular culprit. In the lab, researchers grew the bacteria bathed in a broth. After siphoning off the liquid and filtering it to remove any cells, Rue and Yersin found that the fluid contained a potent toxin. Small doses of the diphtheria toxin could do great damage to susceptible animals. So scientists mixed the toxin with an iodine solution, which made it far less deadly. Another step. Baring, working with Saibasaburo Kitasato, a Japanese bacteriologist, discovered that weakened tetanus toxin, given repeatedly to experimental animals, prevented those animals from developing symptoms after they were exposed to tetanus bacteria. The toxin had spurred the animals' immune systems to recognize and fend off the invading bacteria. Moreover, when lab workers took blood from those immunized animals and removed the blood cells, the remaining serum contained antibodies to tetanus that, when injected into other animals, provided immunity to those animals, too. Baring applied this same principle to diphtheria, creating a serum that could be used to combat the disease in humans. He was recognized for this work in 1901 with a first-ever Nobel Prize in medicine. The antitoxin wasn't a drug that would kill an infecting microbe. The first antimicrobial drug, Salvarsan, which worked against syphilis, was discovered in 1909. And antibiotics like penicillin, which worked on many infections, didn't become available until decades later. And the antitoxin wasn't a vaccine that would activate the patient's own immune system. But antitoxin for diphtheria was bacteriology's first great weapon, a technique for borrowing products made by another immune system, antibodies that would hang around in the patient's blood long enough to battle the infection. To make large quantities of this life-saving therapy, Rue and two colleagues, Louise Martin and Auguste Chaloux, relied on horses, which produce copious amounts of serum. In Paris, they injected horses with weakened diphtheria toxin. They waited for the animals to produce antibodies in response, then bled the animals and collected the serum. From February to July 1894, at the city's large Hospital des Infantes Malades, or Hospital for Sick Children, Martin, Rue, and Chaloux administered horse serum containing antitoxin to 448 children suffering from diphtheria. Just 109 of them died, giving a fatality rate of 24.3%. Meanwhile, at a pediatric hospital, Armand Trousseau, where the serum was not used, the fatality rate was 60%. Rue presented these results at the International Congress of Hygiene and Demography in Budapest in 1894. One American doctor later wrote that he had never before seen such an ovation displayed by an audience of scientific men Hats were thrown to the ceiling. Grave scientific men rose to their feet and shouted their applause in all languages of the civilized world. For any child sick with diphtheria at the very end of the 19th century, the key question was whether the antitoxin would be available. It came to New York City almost immediately. Herman Biggs, Chief Inspector of Pathology, Bacteriology, and Disinfection at the New York City Board of Health, learned about the antitoxin during a trip to Europe in 1894, and he cabled a colleague to start making serum. When the city wouldn't provide immediate funding for horses and equipment, Biggs and a colleague T. Mitchell Pruden put up some of their own money, and the New York Herald raised funds in a subscription campaign. The horses were stabled at the New York College of Veterinary Surgeons on East 57th Street. Within a year, New York City had given 25,000 doses of antitoxin to patients. But the therapy was distributed unevenly in the United States. When the young son of W.E.B. Du Bois got sick, Du Bois, the historian and activist who had been the first African-American to earn a doctoral degree at Harvard, left Philadelphia in 1897 for an academic job in Atlanta. In 1899, his two-year-old son, Burghardt, came down with diphtheria symptoms. In Du Bois' classic 1903 book, The Souls of Black Folk, he wrote about his child's death. And then one night, the little feet pattered wearily to the wee white bed, and the tiny hands trembled, and a warm, flushed face tossed on the pillow. And we knew baby was sick, he wrote. 10 days he lay there, a swift week and 3 endless days, wasting away. The night before Burghardt's death, his father had gone looking for a black doctor, assuming that no white doctor in Atlanta would treat a black child. But he was unable to get treatment for his son. Dubois' wife, Nina, believed that if the family had stayed in Philadelphia, the child would have survived. His parents chose to take his body back to Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where Du Bois had spent his own childhood. As Du Bois wrote, "We could not lay him in the ground there in Georgia, for the earth there is strangely red. So we bore him away to the northward, with his flowers and his little folded hands." The case is so well known in public health circles that a couple of physicians recently revisited the question of whether diphtheria antitoxin was in fact available in Atlanta at the time of Burghardt Du Bois' death. In a 2015 article in the Journal of National Medical Association, Robert Karp and Bobby Gearing drew on newspaper accounts and other sources and reported that at least one Atlanta physician, J.A. Summerfield, who was white, had apparently received a shipment of antitoxin from France. If there was any antitoxin for diphtheria in Atlanta in 1899, the journal authors wrote, it would have been available only to Summerfield's patients. There would have been some chance of getting the antitoxin in Philadelphia, where a physician named Edwin Rosenthal was providing the therapy at a clinic that promised equal access without regard to race, creed, or national origin. Still, Philadelphia's public health service was faulty, and its diphtheria death rates were high. Burghardt Du Bois' chance for survival, the article concluded, would have increased manyfold had the family lived in Boston or Berlin. Deaths from diphtheria dropped dramatically in places where the antitoxin was most available, and the public health infrastructure was most efficient. Cities like Berlin, Paris, New York, Chicago, and Denver In some cities, leaders were working to make bacterial diagnosis and treatment available to all. The New York Board of Health also placed quarantine placards on tenements in which diphtheria or measles or scarlet fever appeared. As Hammonds, the historian, points out, the signs had the effect of making these infections much more visible, which perhaps helped stop the spread of the disease, but also, to some extent, stigmatized the people living in those buildings. The New York Herald and the New York Times chronicled the dissemination of this new therapy and also argued in editorials that it should be administered by public health officials, not by private doctors. The Herald said the therapy would save thousands of human lives, especially the lives of the little ones of the poor, who have always been shining marks for the dread darts of this most fatal of scourges. Yet the antitoxin couldn't save everyone. In 1904, former President Grover Cleveland and his wife Frances lost their daughter Ruth, a popular figure known affectionately as Baby Ruth, to the diphtheria at the age of 12. Though she'd received the antitoxin the day before. The therapy provoked severe side effects in many children who developed fevers, rashes or pain and swelling of the joints, reactions to other substances in the horse serum besides the protective antibodies. Significantly, the antitoxin was not the same as the inactivated toxin that would later be included in the vaccine. It did not prompt a child's own immune system to make antibodies, but instead transferred those antibodies made by the horse. A child infected by diphtheria and successfully treated with horse serum could later contract the infection again. So when von Behring, whose earlier contributions had earned him the Nobel von before his last name, developed a vaccine against diphtheria, the work was hailed as major progress. His vaccine had two components, diphtheria antitoxin, which could battle an active infection, and also an inactivated version of the toxin produced by the bacteria. Since the vaccine didn't include any actual bacteria, it couldn't cause a diphtheria infection. But exposing patients to the toxin, in weakened form, stimulated their immune systems to make long-lasting antibodies. Within several years of von Behring's achievement, massive pediatric immunization programs were underway in New York City. A pediatrician named Bella Schick, also developed a test similar to the TB skin tests still used today, in which the doctor injected a tiny amount of diphtheria toxin into the skin. A person who had not been previously exposed to diphtheria and thus had no immunity to it would develop a red bump at the site. A person who already carried antibodies to diphtheria would not react. The skin test would prove useful in screening patients for vaccination, as shown by New York City health officials William Halleck Park's study of 180,000 New York City school children. Half of them were administered the Schick test, and children who showed a reaction, they were not already immune, received a vaccine. Others, not tested, not vaccinated, developed four times as many cases of diphtheria. With funds from the American Red Cross and later the extensive support of the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, diphtheria immunization continued. In New York City, school nurses were key in these campaigns. Public health authorities provided information in Yiddish, Italian, and just about every other language that would help the vaccine reach immigrant communities. By 1929, the city was also opening diphtheria immunization stations in parks. Perhaps the most famous episode in the battle against diphtheria played out in the territory of Alaska. Curtis Welch, the only physician in Nome, was aware that Native Alaskans had little or no immunity against diphtheria. He ordered antitoxin for his patients in 1924, but the local harbor froze before a ship could deliver the treatment. By 1925, he was seeing children suffering from diphtheria. There had to be a way to bring in the anti-serum. 300,000 units were at a hospital in Anchorage waiting to be delivered. Illustrating just how far authorities were willing to go to distribute the vaccine, Welch arranged for the vials to be carried by train part of the way and to cover the remaining 674 miles. Governor Scott Bone planned a dog sled relay involving 20 teams of dogs and their drivers. As the world followed their journey via newspapers and film reels, the heroic dogs carried the metallic cylinder containing the vials of antitoxin. People everywhere cheered on the men guiding the teams across the frozen landscape. One of the dogs was the subject of Togo, a 2019 Disney movie, and another, Balto, is immortalized in a much-beloved statue in New York's Central Park, a noble bronze tribute to an extraordinary adventure in the prevention of human suffering. The groundbreaking campaigns of the 1920s and 30s evolved into a universal program of infant vaccination in the United States. A DTaP vaccine, created in the 1940s, combined diphtheria and tetanus toxoids with an inactivated version of the bacteria that caused whooping cough, pertussis. Today's DTaP vaccine still contains inactivated diphtheria and tetanus toxins, and it has been reformulated to include proteins from pertussis, but it includes no actual bacterial cells. The vaccine generates immune reactions that protect against all three diseases. The CDC recommends that children receive Tdap shots at 2, 4, 6, and 15 months, and between 4 and 6 years old. A booster shot at 11 or 12 involves a different vaccine called Tdap, spelled with a capital T, lowercase DAP, formulated for older people, which can then be given every 10 years. Largely, as a result of routine, low-cost vaccination, diphtheria is rare in the U.S. The WHO makes recommendations similar to the CDC's, and public officials in most nations urge parents to get their children vaccinated. Despite all the progress preventing and treating the disease, diphtheria has not been eradicated and still flares up around the world, according to a recent analysis of cases by Christy Clark, a CDC epidemiologist. She counted almost 9,000 diphtheria cases globally in 2017. Outbreaks tend to occur in places destabilized by population migration and political strife. She cited Bangladesh, Yemen, Nigeria, and Venezuela. Diphtheria emerges, she told me, when anything disrupts routine vaccination. And the disease is still a killer. The mortality rate usually cites 5 to 10%, but fatalities can be especially high in areas where medical care is not available. A 2011 outbreak in Nigeria had a case fatality rate of almost 43% in children 4 and younger. For those who do get the disease, diphtheria antitoxin is still a mainstay of treatment. But Clark told me the antitoxin is in short supply globally. Strangely, the technology of producing the antitoxin has not changed much. It is still made by injecting horses with weakened diphtheria. Michael Hust and Esther Wenzel, medical researchers at the Technische Universität in Braunschweig, Germany, are trying to change that. Their work involves developing a recombinant antibody molecule, building it genetically in the laboratory and amplifying it through cloning, rather than infecting animals and letting their immune systems do the work. The laboratory-made antibody is well-designed to attack the diphtheria toxin, and if all goes well, it will have fewer side effects than the horse-derived vaccine, because the new medicine will be what Wenzel calls a fully human product, based on antibodies originally manufactured by human cells, reducing the chance the body will react to it as a foreign substance. In an optimal world, we would all be vaccinated. We would not need these antibodies. But you have a lot of outbreaks in different parts of the world, Hust told me. In Europe, he said, the antitoxin still sometimes has to be rushed from one country to another and arrives too late. As with many vaccines, the initial infant series of diphtheria vaccinations is not enough to confer robust lifelong immunity. So children and even adults may become susceptible to the disease if physicians and health officials neglect to administer boosters. Clark's work helped the World Health Organization develop new guidelines, emphasizing the importance of the boosters. At a time when so many Americans are distrustful of vaccines, I often think about the talks I used to have with parents in the 1990s. We were still using the old DTP vaccine, which meant children sometimes experienced side effects, especially fevers and sore arms. The discomfort was not nearly as terrifying as the diseases it inoculated against, but parents had no firsthand experience with the disease themselves, thanks to years of successful vaccinations. My challenge was to help them understand that when they got their babies vaccinated, they were doing their part in a great triumph of human ingenuity and public health. The whole point was to keep those babies safe. In a Canadian Journal article from 1927, a doctor recalled the years before the antitoxin was available, when he'd had to watch a beautiful girl of 5 or 6 years choke to death. Later, the doctor's own daughter came down with diphtheria, but a decade had passed and now the antitoxin was available. To watch the choking, dreadful membrane melt away and disappear in a few hours with complete restoration of health within a few days, he wrote, was one of the most dramatic and thrilling experiences of my professional career. As science and medicine move forward, vaccines and treatments allow parents and physicians to care for children without dreading some of the most terrifying infections of the past. Remembering these success stories can help us maintain a feeling of awe, gratitude, and willingness to do our part. Our author, Perry Klass, is the author of A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. Our next article is of the weather science. The National Weather Service began as a crowdsourcing experiment. Smithsonian Secretary Joseph Henry used an army of volunteers and what would eventually become the nation's weather forecasting operation by Eric Holthaus. For centuries, humans complained about the weather. In 1848, the Smithsonian Institution decided to do something about it. Weather conditions had been considered to be either God's will or explainable only by homespun nostrums like clear moon, frost soon, or by observing, say, the behavior of ants, which don't like rain. The Farmer's Almanac promised readers more accurate forecasts when it debuted in 1818, but even those predictions were determined by a secret formula, and still are. Joseph Henry, the first secretary of the Smithsonian, tried something new, crowdsourcing. The institution handed out weather monitoring equipment such as thermometers, barometers, and rain gauges to 150 volunteer observers across the country. Each day, their localized reports arrived by telegraph, and the Smithsonian generated a national weather map that is displayed on the National Mall. The map became a popular attraction. Tourists who viewed it, Henry noted, appeared to be especially interested in knowing the condition of weather to which their friends at home were subjected at the time. An amusing novelty, but no consolation for those pioneers crossing North America, the continent of some of the most violent weather on Earth. Only 2 years before, 42 members of the Donner Party perished in an early Sierra Nevada snowfall they had no way of foreseeing. In time, the number of Smithsonian volunteers grew to more than 600. Technology improved, and slowly auditors found ways of determining what rudimentary climate data collected about the skies over Denver might soon mean to the skies over Chicago and New York as weather moved east. Reports about temperature, humidity, wind, and cloud formations flooded in. Still, data didn't always reach the right place at the right time. For example, on the Great Lakes, 97 ships were lost in one 4-day gale in 1869. In the year following that tragedy, President Ulysses S. Grant signed a resolution into law creating the Division of Telegrams and Reports for the Benefit of Commerce. The Smithsonian's weather observation network was turned over to the Army, which began issuing official forecasts capable of seeing, if hazily, 24 hours ahead. The threat from sudden weather disasters diminished. Ship-borne commerce vastly improved. Doing business in America increasingly meant knowing the weather ahead. The division would evolve into the National Weather Service, part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the Commerce Department. The first U.S. weather balloons took flight in 1909. Improving the study of temperature, humidity, and air pressure. Another breakthrough came in the 1920s, when the balloons were equipped with radio transmitters and real-time observation of the stratosphere became possible. For the first time, researchers observed not only the width of a weather system, but also its height. During World War II, radar operators noticed patterns of interference on their screens aligned with heavy weather, and the science of radar meteorology took off and is still in use today. So confident were some mid-20th century weather mavens that they speculated the heavens could be manipulated by chemically altering the atmosphere. Bespoke weather, they believed, would bring rain to farmlands, snow to ski resorts. That quixotic dream didn't pan out, however, and Americans today are delighted to settle for smartphone weather apps powered by NWS computer and satellite data that give accurate information they can access instantly to stay safe. The average 3-day hurricane landfall forecast can now pinpoint as much more specific swath of at-risk coastline, 100 miles in 2020, compared with 300 miles in 1990, reducing the stress and cost of false alarms. Over the same period, the average tornado warning time has risen from 5 minutes to 8 to 10 minutes. Will climate change erode our confidence in everyday weather prediction? Not in the short term, says Beth Carpenter, a meteorologist and co-founder of Thermodynamics Solutions, an Indianapolis-based firm. Climate change itself won't affect weather modeling because the timescales are vastly different. We are forecasting on a much smaller timescale, usually only out to 3 months at a time for seasonal forecasts at the longest range. Climate periods are defined as average conditions over 30 years. North America's weather is no less violent than it was when the Donner Party, oblivious, set sail in their prairie schooners before succumbing victims of what Joseph Henry would call the problem of American storms. But the NWS, now with 4,000 workers, will keep finding safer ways for us to live with them. That's a sunny forecast, no matter where you are. I'm going to stop right there, tell you our author, Eric Holthaus, is a meteorologist and writer whose first book is The Future Earth, A Radical Vision for What's Possible in the Age of Warming. Everybody, have a delightfully weather-perfect fall week. This is Jody signing off.